This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. You may know the name Whitey Bulger as the Boston criminal that inspired Jack Nicholson's character in the film The Departed. You may remember his capture in Santa Monica, California 2 years ago after 16 years on the run as one of the FBI's most wanted men. But Whitey Bulger's story is extraordinary in many ways. While he was becoming one of Boston's most notorious criminals, his brother Bill was becoming one of the most powerful men in the Massachusetts legislature. Whitey ran guns for the IRA, once firebombed John F. Kennedy's birthplace to protest school busing in Boston, and repeatedly took LSD in prison as part of a CIA-sponsored experiment. But nothing in Bulger's criminal career is more remarkable than his close collaboration with FBI agents who used him as an informant. Our guest today, journalists Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy, say that relationship became corrupt and that several agents protected Bulger from investigators looking into multiple murders he was ultimately charged with. Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy are both veteran reporters for the Boston Globe. Cullen is a Pulitzer Prize winner, and Murphy is a recipient of the George Polk Award. Their new book is Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Kevin Cullen, Shelley Murphy, welcome to Fresh Air. This book is just a great read, I have to tell you. So many terrific, amazing stories in here. It's a story of a remarkable career criminal and a shameful episode in the history of the FBI, but also a story of a city and a neighborhood. Tell us a little bit about South Boston and the Bulger family.
Well, South Boston is literally a peninsula and figuratively an island. It's a place set apart from Boston, in Boston. It's sort of always thought of itself. We talk about American exceptionalism. Well, there was Southie exceptionalism because folks that live in that neighborhood, and that included me for a big chunk of my life, thought of themselves as living in the best part of the city. It's not unusual for people to refer to it as God's country.
So it's a tight-knit community, row houses, primarily very, Irish back in those days or no?
It was heavily Irish, but it was just very ethnic. There were a lot of people, a lot of Poles there. There were people from Lithuania. There were Italians. It was a mix, but certainly it's not only predominantly Irish, it's Irish in ethos. If you're there, you're almost Irish by osmosis in South Boston because even in the public schools, kids would learn Irish songs. That's the kind of Irish ethos that ran through South Boston. And even the unofficial mascot of the town, as natives refer to that neighborhood, it's the fighting Irish, the leprechaun in sort of a boxing pose, the belligerent boxing pose with his fist up. And it's a tough part of town, and it always was. And Whitey grew up in a time when it was particularly blue-collar and particularly rough around the edges, and where he grew up, it was particularly rough around the edges. It was a housing project.
All right, so let's talk about him. Whitey Bulger, his name was James, right? Belonged to a big family. Did he get into crime early?
He did get into crime early. His first arrest was at age 13. He started, with stealing, tailgating, hanging out down by the waterfront where they would, steal products off the back of trucks.
Yeah, one thing that struck that we found out in one of the letters that we reviewed, Whitey talked about when he was 16 years old, he was in the back of a precinct house in South Boston, and he said a police officer jammed a gun in his mouth, and the police officer was leaning so close to him that he could smell the liquor on his breath. It was a really dramatic scene, but even at that tender age of 16, Whitey was, clearly in the fast life and in the criminal life. And I think that sort of began that sort of confrontational attitude he had with authority right there. I mean, he was somebody who was going to have situations like that.
He becomes a bank robber, gets caught, and at age 26 gets a lengthy prison sentence, ends up doing part of it at Alcatraz. He gets paroled in 1965. And finds his way back to South Boston. And you write about there had been a series of gang wars among the Irish criminals in the neighborhood, and peace was made. And Whitey gets out and ends up becoming one of the most important criminals in Boston, one of the Irish criminals in the area. He ends up establishing quite a place for himself, him and a longtime associate named Steve Flemmy. They became important criminals in the city. How did he make his money then? What did they do?
Well, timing is everything. And when you look at it, Whitey was able to emerge from prison to a very depleted underworld. There were over 60 people killed, mostly Irish gangsters, while he was away in prison. And so he was able to rise very quickly. And he asserted himself, you know, he had told everybody, and a lot of people believed him, that he was going to go straight. But we found in our research that, you know, he dove pretty quickly back into the underworld, and he became an enforcer for a group called the Killeen Brothers. They were the preeminent gangsters in South Boston at the time, and they had a massive, extensive bookmaking operation. There was a lot of money to be made in that. And so Whitey became a protector for them. You know, he would have been a strong-arm guy. He would have been going around forcing people to pay their debts. Now, he kind of knew Flemmy because when he got out of prison, one of the first things he did, he went to this after-hours club in the Roxbury section of Boston, outside of South Boston, and he tried to basically get himself back in that life.
All right, so Whitey Bulger becomes a successful, dangerous, intimidating, and money-earning criminal. But this is a fascinating story in its connection to the FBI. There's this agent, John Connolly, who has a long, close relationship with Whitey Bulger. Tell us about him. How did he know the Bulger family?
It goes right back to that housing project where it all began, Dave. It's, you know, John Connolly grew up on the same housing project. And they grew up in this place in South Boston where loyalty was everything. Loyalty to your family, loyalty to your neighborhood, loyalty to your neighbors. And so Connolly actually, you know, one of the important influences on his life when he was growing up was Billy Bulger. Because Billy Bulger, he saw as, you know, that's what I want to be. I want to study. I want to get ahead. And Bill Bulger was, you know, instrumental in pointing the right way for John Connolly. Go to school, you know, go to college. And so John Connolly went to Boston College. And then John Connolly became an FBI agent. And when John Connolly was transferred back after a few years on the road to the Boston office, one of the first things he decided to do was seek out Whitey Bulger as an informant. And the reason he did that is that while Whitey was, by this time, one of the preeminent Irish gangsters in Boston, at this time, the mafia was the national priority of the FBI. The FBI didn't take into account regional differences. They wouldn't look at Boston and say, well, geez, the Irish guys are just as bad as the Italians. We better take them both out. That wasn't what was going on. And so Connolly approached Jimmy Bulger, as he would call him, Whitey, and recruited him as an informant, ostensibly to help the FBI take on the mafia. One problem with that approach is that Whitey Bulger didn't know much about the mafia. How he could, the difference is Steve Flemmy, his criminal partner, really did know a lot. So they became, you know, two for the price of one. The FBI actually put them together. So they were a tag team. And as soon as Whitey agreed to become an informant for the FBI, he realized what a deal this was because he immediately went out and killed a guy that he had been wanting to kill probably for a long time and then went to see his handler and give him the report that, you know, and he would implicate somebody else in the killing. And then the other thing he did right after he became an informant, he really stepped up his involvement with the IRA, sending them weapons, and that culminated with the biggest shipment ever sent from America to the IRA in 1984, which he had a huge role in.
There's a woman named Deborah Davis who was killed. I mean, there are too many murders for us to go into detail, but this is an interesting one. She was a girlfriend of Steve Flemmy, right?
Yeah, she was a young girl. She was only a teenager working in a jewelry store when he walked in and she caught his eye. Beautiful, gorgeous young girl who looked a lot like a young Farrah Fawcett. He started dating her at the time. He like Whitey, had various women in his life. He already, you know, was living with another woman and had children by her. But he started dating Deborah, and this relationship lasted for about 9 years. As he was buying her, you know, jewelry and Jaguars and Mercedes, and she was very happy for a while with that life. But at some point, she wanted marriage. She wanted kids. She wanted a family, and he didn't want any of that. She went on a vacation that he had paid for to Acapulco and met this wealthy businessman and fell in love. She came back and tried to break it off with Steve Flemmy. But unfortunately for her, she knew about his relationship with the FBI. She knew that he had been having meetings with John Connolly. And Whitey and Steve Flemmy, according to testimony in court, decided that she was a liability. So the way that Steve Flemmy tells the story is He told her that he wanted her to see a home that he had just purchased for his parents. Now, this house happened to be right next door to Bill Bulger's home in South Boston. And on a night in September of 1981, 26-year-old Deborah Davis walks into this home, and according to Flemmy, Whitey is waiting and strangles her. Flemmy kisses her on the forehead and says, "You're going to a better place." They buried her body along the banks of the Neponset River just south of South Boston in Quincy, and her remains weren't found for years. But it's one of the 19 murders that Whitey's charged with and one of two women he's accused of killing.
Right, and you make the point in the book that Whitey denies ever having killed a woman, but Flemmy says he was there and did this. Now, the important thing about her is this. Her mother, Deborah Davis, the victim's mother, believed that Flemmy was behind it all along. And told the FBI this, right? And how did they respond?
Well, it was at a time in the Boston office when there were starting to be some suspicion about the relationship by some agents about the relationship between Conley and Whitey and Flemmy. And two agents interview Deborah Davis's mother, Olga, and she talks about, you know, "My daughter vanished. I believe that Flemmy is responsible." But the agents did not compile any reports. Now later they said they were concerned about leaving any sort of a paper trail. But it's very strange how this whole thing played out. You have this notorious gangster. He's dating this woman. She vanishes without a trace. And they did put a report in the FBI, you know, National Computer Database listing her as a missing person. And then mysteriously, there's an update to that report that, oh, she's no longer missing. She's been, you know, spotted somewhere in Texas, which was a complete lie. Someone in the FBI went into that database and altered the report. So her mother, you know, was really afraid. She didn't really trust Flemmy. And now Flemmy's hanging around the house, taking up with the younger sister, buying her a car. And so, you know, I think it put the mother in kind of a tough place, and nobody really investigated.
Right.
Dave, you know, it's very important, the timing of this, because the Deborah Davis killing was one of several that followed in the next few years, in which the FBI not only looked the other way, but they actually thwarted the attempts of honest law enforcement officers to hold Whitey and Stevie Flemmy accountable for these killings. That is the most egregious act you will find in that book, in our book. I mean, it's appalling the way this was handled, because the reason the FBI was so afraid of doing the right thing then is because Whitey Bulger and Steve Flemmy were used as confidential informants to obtain the probable cause that allowed the FBI to plant bugs in the headquarters of the mafia in Boston. And so they're looking at these guys as assets. So here's the FBI on one hand. In Boston, they're about to make the most important prosecution in the history of the office of the FBI, taking out the leadership of La Cosa Nostra in Boston. And the guys that helped them get this case are implicated in a whole series of murders. So they didn't just look the other way. They made sure that nothing happened to Steve Flemmy and Whitey Bulger.
This is an amazing situation where you have these two guys, Whitey Bulger and Steve Flemmy, committing murders, and the FBI covering up for them, misleading other authorities who are onto these murders, while these same two criminals are giving at least two of these FBI agents gifts and cash, and the Bureau's kind of engaged in protecting them. And you're right. And in the late 80s, the Boston Globe got onto this and started writing a story about Whitey, about his brother, who was at this point a powerful man in the Massachusetts legislature, and about Whitey's relationship with this FBI agent, John Connolly. And Kevin Cullen, you write that you were visited by an FBI agent while you were working on this story. Tell us about that.
Well, I actually got a phone call.
Okay.
Here's the background. John Connolly was my best FBI source. I mean, John Connolly knew my family. It goes back to Southie again. And he did things and said things that made me very uncomfortable. He just kept praising Whitey and telling me how wonderful he is. And, you know, and then my cousins are telling me that Whitey's killing people and he's pushing drugs all over the town. So it really bothered me. So I went to our editors in, you know, I think it would have been 87 or 88 when we first started planning the series. I just said, I think Whitey's a rat. There's no other explanation for why he would be allowed to be out there. The FBI should have been going after him years ago. And so we began that process, and we found law enforcement people who were able to corroborate that in fact Whitey was an informant. And about 2 months before we went with this series, it was part of, it's called the Spotlight Team, it's our investigative unit at the Globe, I got a call from an FBI agent named Tom Daley. He said that he had heard from one of his informants, who was now in the witness protection program, that we were going to do this story and that we were going to name Whitey Bulger as an informant. The agent told me that it's not true, and he said that if you report something that's not true, Whitey will not live with that. And he said he would think nothing of clipping you, Kevin, and you know you live there. So I lived in South Boston. We actually huddled as a team after that. Obviously, I was a little disturbed by the phone call. And we kind of decided that if the FBI was serious about this, there would have been a formal notification process. That said, I was shaken enough that I would talk to other law enforcement people that I really trusted and believed in the Massachusetts State Police and the DEA, and let them know what the FBI said. So they would know. We wanted that on the record. And we ended up going with the series, but as a precaution, the Globe decided to put my wife and I up in a hotel outside of the city. And I told my wife that the concern was that maybe somebody wouldn't like the series or the stories, and they'd throw rocks through our window. I wasn't totally honest with my wife at the time.
You didn't tell her about the FBI call?
I didn't tell her about that until much later after that. We had a very nice week in a very fine hotel. And the state police had worked their informants during that week to see what Whitey's reaction would have been to the series. And the only thing that came back from the state police informants is that Whitey didn't like one section of the series in which we reported that he beat up a wino in front of Teresa Stanley's house. He said that was no wino. Apparently, he thought that made him look like a bully if he beat up a wino. But he didn't say anything about the informant part of it. Now, obviously, he was furious about it. But he actually told the FBI after this was revealed in the Boston Globe that nobody would believe it.
Which is kind of what happened, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, people didn't believe he was an informant, right?
Well, one of the most criminals. Incredible things, if you see in the book, Dave, we asked Anthony Cardinale, a very, very well-respected lawyer who's represented some of the most senior mafia figures in the country, including John Gotti, Tony Salerno, and Jerry Angiulo here in Boston. And Tony asked them all separately, why didn't anybody make a move on Bulger after the Globe put that in the paper? And they all said the same thing. They said, they didn't believe that the FBI would get into bed with somebody as vicious and as venal as Whitey Bulger. So the mafia actually had a higher view of the FBI than it deserved.
Well, let's move this story toward its conclusion here. I mean, eventually the state police and the Drug Enforcement Administration make a case against Whitey and his associates, not for the murders, but for some other crimes. Whitey gets tipped off by his FBI friend John Connolly and goes on the lam, where he is at large for 16 years. And then his associates start cooperating. They realize they're in trouble, and so details of these murders come out one by one. But there's an interesting chapter in this tale about how the FBI's complicity with Whitey Bulger and his criminal friend Steve Flemmy, how that story comes out, and it involves this federal judge, Mark Wolf. Tell us about that.
When John Connolly warns Bulger's associate that indictments are about to come down, he says they should flee. But Flemmy does not take that advice. He hangs around and he's caught. Now he's sitting in jail, and he decides his best defense is to claim that they were informants and they had immunity from prosecution. And at that time, they were charged with just gambling and loan sharking and shaking down drug dealers. And the defense is that the FBI gave us immunity from prosecution with the caveat that we not kill anyone. Judge Wolf held hearings that lasted throughout the year. And as some of their co-defendants are sitting there listening to, the fact that Whitey and Steve Flemmy were informants, they're furious. And they can see the writing on the wall. They're afraid that if Flemmy decides to now, cooperate, that they'll all be implicated in murders. And it's basically a race to be the first one to cooperate. And so the first one is a hitman, John Moderano, who who tells about murders that happened in the 60s and 70s. And then later, much later, you know, another associate, longtime associate of Whitey Bulger's cooperates, and he leads them to the secret graves. And what's happening behind the scenes is, you know, the state police and the DEA are seeing this case sort of unravel. I mean, the idea that, you know, how could the original indictment was that, you know, the head of the New England Mafia at the time and Bulger and Flemmy were controlling the rackets around the city, that they were dividing up, you know, territory. But now that case was falling apart. How could there be, you know, a conspiracy that involved the Mafia and Whitey Bulger being partners when Whitey was an informant against the Mafia? So seeing the case fall apart really spurred the DEA and the state police to go out and start, you know, trying to gather new evidence. You know, they cut some deals that were very controversial, men who admitted to murders and got these unbelievable deals. I mean, they served time in prison and are now free. But what they gave is they gave the story of the FBI's, you know, what was happening behind the scenes, the secret graves, which led to this new murder indictment.
Right. And so this judge, I mean, he bores into, as these people talk, he bores into the story about the murders and the FBI's relationship with Whitey and Bulger, and then writes, what, a 600-some-odd page report?
It was an opus, 661 pages. I think what Judge Wolf did more than anything was to challenge the Justice Department's self-serving narrative that this was just a scandal that involved a rogue agent and his rogue supervisor. I think if you read the book, you will see that the conspiracy involved many people in the FBI. It's been very convenient for the FBI, with the connivance of the Justice Department, to spin this as, you know, John Conley did this and John Morris let him get away with it. I have a certain sympathy for John Conley in the sense that he did everything the FBI told him to and everything that the FBI rewarded him for, and that was making informants. And but he's the guy holding the bag. He's the guy doing 40 years in prison now for helping Whitey Bulger kill somebody.
Right, but they didn't tell him to accept hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash,
obviously,
which he did.
Obviously,
right? Yeah.
I think that what's important here is, you know, John, there's been overwhelming evidence that John Connolly crossed the line, but I think the point here is that he wasn't the only one who crossed the line, and there have been civil proceedings, you know, based on wrongful death suits filed by the families of some of these victims, where the judges have found that the FBI as an institution was liable, that there was evidence of, you know, deliberately sticking its head in the sand and not doing what it should have done, and that this was not a case of just a couple of rogue agents, that this couldn't have happened without approval at very high levels of the FBI and the Justice Department.
After John Conley was convicted, the special prosecutor, John Durham, said that he would release a report that would identify the misconduct and criminal activity, if they found it, of all the other FBI officials involved in this. That report, we're still waiting for it.
And that was 11 years ago.
And Mr. Durham has moved on to the CIA case, so we're still waiting.
Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy's new book is Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Bulger's trial on murder and other charges is scheduled for June. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In the internet age, it's gotten easy to detect historical anachronisms in the language of movies and TV shows. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg spots a lot of them himself, but sometimes wonders if we end up choosing the wrong things to nitpick over.
Has there ever been an age that was so grudging about suspending its disbelief? The groundlings at the Globe Theater didn't giggle when Shakespeare had a clock chime in Julius Caesar. The Victorians didn't take Dickens to task for having the characters in A Tale of Two Cities ride the Dover mail coach 10 years before it was established. But Shakespeare and Dickens weren't writing in the age of the Internet, when every historical detail is scrutinized for chronological correctness, and when no gotcha remains unposted for long. Reporters using flashbulbs in 1919 in J. Edgar, transatlantic twin-engine jets in Argo, it completely took me out of the movie. In a climate of insistent authenticity, there's nothing harder to get right than a period's vocabulary. The past speaks a foreign language, which even those who grew up with can't recover. The producers of Mad Men take pride in fitting out their characters with the correct ties and timepieces. But as the Boston Globe's Ben Zimmer observed, they can't seem to keep anachronisms out of the scripts. Were we already saying keep a low profile in 1963? Actually, no, it didn't catch on till 1969. But who can remember this stuff? Other writers don't even make much of an effort to get the dialogue right. Spotting linguistic anachronisms in Julian Fellowes's Downton Abbey is as easy as shooting grouse in a barrel. I couldn't care less, Lord Grantham says. Thomas complains that our lot always gets shafted. And Cousin Matthew announces he's been on a steep learning curve, a phrase that would have gotten a blank stare even in the Sterling Cooper boardroom. Those clangers are just too weirdly modern to ignore. It's not that Fellowes lacks an ear for the speech of the Edwardian age. It's that he doesn't seem to have much of an ear for the speech of this one. But I give a pass to anachronisms if they don't jump out at me. No, Mrs. Patmore probably wouldn't have said when push comes to shove, and Lord Grantham should have waited a couple of decades before telling his chauffeur to step on it. But that isn't what's problematic about Downton's vision of the past. Even when the characters are speaking authentic period words, they aren't using them to express authentic period thoughts. The Earl, who frets over his duties as a job creator, the servants grappling with their own homophobia, those are comfortable modern reveries. Drop any of them into a period drawing room comedy by Shaw or Pinero, and they'd be as out of place as a flat-screen TV. The modern obsession with authenticity can be deceptive. It can make a narrative sound superficially plausible, even when it's deeply false to its moment. Those are the movies that remind you of Civil War battle reenactments, with all those optometrists and computer programmers with their impeccably accurate uniforms and their rows of perfect teeth. The stakes are higher when dramas render actual events. We naturally cut less slack to Steven Spielberg's Lincoln than to Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. And the screenwriter Tony Kushner, by and large, got it right. There are some minor anachronisms. People back then didn't talk about hometown newspapers, and Mary Todd Lincoln would have worried about sharpshooters, not snipers. But there are no clunkers like the ones that populate Downton Abbey. But avoiding the words that people didn't use back then is ultimately just a mechanical problem. There's a history graduate student named Ben Schmidt who's actually written a program that tags all the phrases in a script that don't appear in the books of its era. The bigger challenge is to convey the meanings of the words that people did use, especially when they resonate differently now. Equality, prejudice, race itself. How can you have mid-19th century characters use words like those without anachronistically evoking the connotations they have for us? To many of Lincoln's contemporaries and even his allies, equality still evoked alarming echoes of the French Revolution. To speak of race equality implied not just that people should all be treated alike, but that the races really were morally and intellectually equivalent. That was an extreme and dubious proposition to all but a few radical Republicans like Thaddeus Stevens. Lincoln himself almost certainly didn't believe it, nor did the prominent scientists of the age. In fact, race equality was the phrase the defenders of slavery used to charge that the Republicans wanted to raise Negroes to the same status as whites and encourage miscegenation, charges that most Republicans indignantly and sincerely denied. It's discomforting to read the accounts of those debates in Michael Vorenberg's Final Freedom, the book that Kushner chiefly drew on in depicting them. It's hard for us to adapt our understanding of words like equality to a 19th century moral frame. And it's to Kushner's credit that there are some overtones of those attitudes in the screenplay. In fact, if you listen closely to the movie, equality oscillates between its old and modern meanings, between authenticity and anachronism. It could leave you a little off balance, particularly if you ignore the promptings of John Williams' incessantly exalting score. Actually, the linguist in me wouldn't have minded more of that unsettled feeling. A historical novel or screenplay should give us a translation, not a transcription. And a great translation should allow us to hear a stubbornly alien language rustling in the background. What would it be like to have a Lincoln that we couldn't so comfortably and easily make our own?
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Public health officials have expressed alarm in recent years at the growth in obesity and diabetes among Americans and their relationship to sweet and salty, often fat-laden, processed foods. Our guest, journalist Michael Moss, has spent years covering American food companies, and in his new book, he looks at food industry labs where scientists carefully craft snacks, desserts, and processed meals we just can't resist. He says they find that salt, sugar, and fat are magic ingredients in producing the tastes and textures that will entice customers and ensure their products' shelf space in supermarkets and convenience stores. In his research, Moss spoke with many food industry scientists and executives, some of whom regret their success in making foods Americans love. Michael Moss is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for his series on the dangers of contaminated meat. His new book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Well, Michael Moss, welcome to Fresh Air. At the beginning of your book, you describe a remarkable meeting in 1999 among leaders of America's largest food companies to talking about growing concerns about health and obesity. This was unknown to reporters at the time?
It was. This was a private meeting of some of the top officials of some of the largest companies in the country who were brought together for this absolutely extraordinary moment when they were told at this meeting that obesity is surging along with other health issues and that the industry was coming to a moment in time when it needed to start wrestling with the health issues in terms of accepting responsibility for at least part of the obesity crisis and holding themselves accountable for trying to come up with part of the solution.
Right. And this was not prompted by activists or regulators, right? How did
that
get organized?
That was one of the most extraordinary things about it, which is that the main presenter at the meeting was a senior official at the largest food giant, Kraft, who in the years leading up to the meeting had become increasingly concerned about the looming obesity crisis and increasingly concerned about the fate of his industry. And during the course of his presentation to the CEOs, he was pleading with them to pay attention to the issue and start thinking about the things that they could do collectively to turn the corner.
But most of the food manufacturers kept doing what they were doing.
They kept doing what they were doing, some cases adding even more salt, sugar, fat into their foods. You know, again, they would continue creating low-fat, low-sugar versions of their mainline products. But the goal remained what it had been for decades prior, which, again, was to make the most convenient, the most long-lasting, the least cost foods that they could. These are companies that are profit-driven. They are addicted to profits as much as we are addicted to salt, sugar, and fat. And you have to, I think when you understand that, you can see where the food industry is coming from and what the prospects might be for changing things to the better of public health.
Now, a lot of your book deals with research among food companies about health and even more about how they can make stuff that we just can't resist. And I guess it's in the section on sugar that you refer to something called the bliss point. Explain that.
This was a mathematical term that was applied to food back in the 1970s by a food scientist who at the time was actually working for the U.S. Army in helping to try to develop food rations for soldiers in the field. His goal was to get soldiers to eat more in the field because they have the contrary problem in warfare, which is, you know, under battle, the last thing you want to do sometimes is to eat food. So the Army was in the position of trying to make its food more attractive and palatable to soldiers and still have it be able to sit on the shelf for 3 years. So this scientist, Howard Moskowitz, was working very hard at figuring out the precise amounts of salt, sugar, fat, and especially sugar in foods that would cause people to go over the moon, and for products eventually, when he started working for food companies, to fly off the shelves. And this became this magical point where sugar was at an optimum level for creating allure, came to be known as the bliss point.
You write about how General Foods and Kellogg were so creative in developing breakfast cereals that were loaded with sugar. And there are some really jaw-dropping marketing pitches in the book. Do you have a favorite?
Well, I was really struck at the campaign that Kellogg ran for Apple Jacks. They decided, and this was in the mid-2000s, they decided that Apple had become problematic to them and that kids maybe weren't drawn to the taste of Apple in Apple Jacks as they were, you know, a couple decades ago when it was invented. They created this campaign, this ad campaign, wherein there were two characters, and one was a cinnamon stick and another was a fresh apple. And in the campaign, as it was unveiled and started out, the apple was made into a bad guy. There were races between the two, and the cinnamon stick was always the one to win, and the apple was stumbling and unattractive and just not something you would want to associate with, and he lost. And it drove nutrition advocates crazy because here they were trying to encourage kids to eat more fresh fruit. Kellogg was giving Apple, however purposefully, a bad name in their eyes. And eventually Kellogg ended up changing the ad so that Apple at least was on equal footing with the cinnamon, which was basically just a euphemism for the added sugar in the cereal.
You write a lot about soda and how, of course, there's a lot of research that directly connects it to the obesity epidemic among young people. A single can of Coke, you know, has, what, like 8 teaspoons of sugar. And you met a guy named Jeffrey Dunn, who had spent a lot of his career at Coca-Cola, which was always in this tooth-and-nail battle with Pepsi. Do you want to describe some of the ways that he and his friends at Coke tried to get Americans to drink more of it as opposed to Pepsi, or just drink more Coke?
I mean, Jeffrey Dunn was just fabulous. I mean, his dad had worked at Coke, and he managed to get a job at Coke himself and rose through the ranks. I mean, he was a master at marketing Coke. And one of the ways that they went after and helped sort of foster the consumption of Coke was they were the first. Coke was to sort of come up with this notion of limitless soda drinking in restaurants. They came up with sort of the endless fountain. So you bought a cup and you were allowed to go back to the fountain to drink as much soda as you possibly could. This was sort of the beginning of the supersize phenomena that we still see going on today.
In 1989, Philip Morris, the tobacco company, acquired two food giants, Kraft and General Foods. And, of course, it's interesting that this happened at a time when Americans were becoming more conscious of health issues, that these two big food companies are acquired by a company that was at the center of the kind of the biggest health product controversy of the century, you know, with tobacco. How did the cigarette maker affect the way food companies made and marketed their products?
Well, in two very different ways. And first, Philip Morris acquired General Foods, and then a couple of years later in 89, merged that with Kraft. In the early years, Philip Morris was doing everything you might expect of them, which was they were holding regular meetings. They called it the corporate products meetings, where they would have their food division officials come in and tell them what new great things they were doing to increase consumption of their products. Philip Morris is about profits. It saw the food divisions as about profits. Over time, though, Philip Morris had a much different view, developed a much different view of their food division. Because as Philip Morris came under pressure for nicotine in cigarettes, it eventually started looking at the food divisions in light of the emerging obesity crisis. And there were moments in these internal documents where Philip Morris officials were saying to the food division, you guys are going to face a problem in terms of obesity of the same magnitude, if not more, than we're facing with nicotine right now. And you've got to start thinking about this issue and how you're going to deal with that.
Well, that's an interesting general proposition, but it runs up against, you know, the profit, you know, imperative. I mean, you want to make stuff that tastes great and that people want to buy. Did they want people to sacrifice profits to, or what did it want them to do?
Well, you're right. And how it unfolded at Kraft is a totally fascinating thing. Philip Morris was nudging Kraft to start reconsidering its dependence on salt, sugar, fat at the very moment a cabal of insiders at Kraft, including Michael Mudd, the official who led and organized the 1999 CEO meeting, they were pushing Kraft to meet the obesity issue head on. And the Philip Morris sort of nudging, you know, encouraged them to push ahead. And ultimately, this cabal at Kraft convinced the top officials of Kraft that they needed to do something. And I think their argument went along a number of lines, but one of them was, look, we're at risk of losing everything here if we don't give up a little bit. So they set out to create this, you know, this anti-obesity initiative. They brought in 10 experts from all different fields to advise it on obesity and look at the ways that the company might be contributing to obesity. They created new, stricter rules that limited their ability to market the most problematic foods to children. They looked at the packaging and decided that they were doing some things on packaging that were quite deceptive. And then finally, and this was sort of the most extraordinary thing, is that they put limits on the amounts of salt, sugar, fat that their scientists, their food technicians could add to food. And this was an extraordinary moment, as they described to me, because up until that point, every ounce of effort at Kraft, as it is at other companies, was focused on making the foods, their foods, as attractive, as alluring, as addictive, if you will, though that's not a word that they choose to use, as possible.
You write a lot about all of the research that they did to make food so alluring, and fat in particular. There's almost no limit to how much fat you'll want in a food.
Yes, that's one of the issues with fat. The other issue is that it's often invisible. Fat comes in oils and solids, and the fat that nutritionists are concerned about, called saturated fat because it's linked to heart disease, is a solid fat, and it's not easily recognizable by us in our brains as being, you know, something you want to be careful about. So I write in the book about cheese as an example of a fat additive to foods that has contributed, no doubt, significantly to the obesity crisis. And it's sort of an amazing story when you go back. You know, in short, back in the 60s, people started drinking less whole milk as a way of lowering their saturated fat and caloric intake. They started turning to skim milk or non-fat milk. That left the dairy industry with this huge and growing supply of milk fat, which they extracted from the whole milk to make the low-fat varieties. You know, because the federal government has been subsidizing the dairy industry for decades and decades, the government stepped in and helped out. And as the food and dairy industry started turning that milk fat into cheese, first the federal government started buying up all the surplus cheese that people couldn't possibly eat. And then they created a marketing program for the dairy industry that encouraged or that helped them market cheese to people so that people would eat more cheese. And it's one of the main reasons why cheese consumption in this country has tripled up to as much as 33 pounds a year per person. And this is not the cheese that we think about that you eat as an appetizer before dinner. One of the amazing things that they did was turn cheese into an ingredient. So it became a fat additive, if you will, to foods, processed foods in many corners of the grocery store in order to increase the allure. Because, and you can tell I'm a real fat lover here, because it has this thing called mouthfeel. Mouthfeel is what the industry calls the reaction you have when you taste cheese. It's the feeling of cheese in your mouth, the gooey, warm texture of cheese, especially when it's melted on a sandwich. Or it's the crunch, the amazingly attractive notion when you bite into a fried chicken. Fat has all these wonderful terms that you don't even think about, but it's all, you know, its main function and its main, the beauty to the industry is that it increases the attractiveness of their foods.
So we have a problem here. I mean, we're all busy people, and so convenience is a plus. Processed foods meet that need. I mean, these products, salt, sugar, and fat, are yummy. These scientists do a terrific job of making them irresistible, and it's clear that there are very serious health effects from all this stuff we're eating. So it raises a question, really, I think, of whether, you know, a competitive capitalist system is capable of dealing with it. I mean, when one company cuts back, it loses market share. It's kind of hard not to conclude that the competition in the food industry is going to prevent companies from giving us healthier things to eat. What do you think? Do we need more government intervention, more soda taxes?
I was surprised to hear from the former CEO, Philip Morris, who is no friend of government and no friend of government regulation, to tell me that, look, Michael, in the case of the processed food industry, I think what you're looking at is a total inability on their part to collectively decide to do the right thing by consumers on the health profile of their products. And in this case, I can see how you might need government regulation, if nothing else, to give the companies cover from the pressure from Wall Street. I know in my own life, I by no means am in a position to give up processed foods. My wife and I both work outside the home. Our kids are 8 and 13. We have a crazy morning schedule like so many Americans do. And I'm hoping this book just gives people more information as they walk into the grocery store so they can walk out with their good health, because there are alternatives. Even in the cereal aisle, one of the things I encourage people to do is spend more time on the ends of the end aisles of the supermarket where the fresh vegetables and fruits are, and to maybe think about ways too that preparing whole foods, you know, maybe isn't all that inconvenient as the food companies have said. And so, you know, I'm hoping that by reading this book, people will find ways to level the playing field in their own shopping and cooking habits, to pull back, you know, in lieu of more government regulation, to just sort of empower themselves. Because ultimately, you know, we're deciding what to buy, how much to eat. And that's a hugely empowering thing when you just start thinking about it.
Michael Moss is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. His new book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. You'll find a much longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.